Okay, good evening once again. This is Richard Klemm. We're coming to you live on February 25th, 2015, and we're going to be looking at some recent appellate decisions from Iowa, Minnesota, and Wisconsin. If we have time, a couple of interesting Indiana cases. We'll look at some of the recent appellate decisions from around the region. This program is being offered for CLE credit, both as a live program tonight and as a podcast. For those of you on either the live program or the podcast, I will be giving a series of code numbers during the program. In order to record your attendance, please email those code numbers to me at the conclusion of the program, and I can get you out your certificate of attendance. And in fact, at this time, I will give you the first of about six code numbers. The first number for you to write down, unless you're in traffic, the first number to write down is A27. A27. A27 is the first code number. And like I say, we're the course materials, which incidentally on the page where you got the information about the program, there's a link for the course materials there, and you can follow along if you want, or if you want to reference them later. I have summaries of some of the cases we're going to be talking about, along with links to the court decision if you want to go into a little bit more detail. And the course materials start with Minnesota, but there are actually a number of interesting Iowa Supreme Court cases. So we're going to start out by turning to the Iowa Supreme Court. The first case we're going to look at is the City of Sioux City versus Michael Jacobsma. And this is a case involving a speed camera. So it's an issue that's bound to hit the Supreme Courts of some other states. And it's gone up to the Iowa Supreme Court, and we'll see how they dealt with it. Anyway, Sioux City decided they wanted to have some speed cameras installed. So they passed an ordinance authorizing them. It's not a criminal offense to speed past a speed camera, but there's a civil penalty associated with driving past a speed camera, which just happens to be the same number of dollars as the fine prescribed for that infraction. So they passed this ordinance. They had an outside contractor who's perhaps making some money in the process. But they have these speed cameras. They paid for all these speed cameras, and so what are you going to do with them? Maybe they have some particularly dangerous stretch of road where they need a little extra enforcement, or maybe there's some part of town where they've been having a lot of accidents. So I guess those might be logical places to put the speed camera. But on the other hand, they have to pay for the thing. So what do you do with it? Well, you put it out on the interstate because you're going to generate a little bit more revenue there. And maybe the people passing through will be from out of town, and maybe they won't object to it quite so much. The Sioux City installed the speed camera on Interstate 29, and sure enough, one day this attorney, Mr. Jacobsma, was driving through town, and according to the speed camera, he was going 77 miles per hour in a 55 mile per hour zone. And he never denied that. He never admitted it, but he never denied that. He got a citation in the mail, and it showed pictures of his car, and there was even a link to the video of his car speeding past this camera. It told him that he had three options. First option, probably taken advantage of by most people, was, just pay the fine. He didn't want to do that. The second option was if your car was stolen or if somebody else had been driving the car, you can fill out an affidavit to that effect. Interestingly, it says that if you fill out an affidavit saying that somebody else was driving, that other person is called the nominated driver. Somebody just joined us. Write down A27, that's the first code that you only missed a couple of minutes, but we're talking about speed cameras in Iowa. But the first code that I gave a couple of minutes ago is A27. The first option was, you just pay the fine. And the second option was you report stolen or in use by another driver. Interestingly, if you say another driver is driving it, it says liability can be transferred only if that nominated driver accepts the responsibility. So you're still on the hook unless some other driver fesses up and admits that they were indeed driving. Or you can elect to have a hearing, and being an attorney, that's what he decided to do. And he fought it on constitutional grounds. He had three arguments, and you have to hand it to him. He argued it well. There was a long decision from the Supreme Court. He argued that it violated his substantive due process. However, the court took a look at it, and they finally decided that they were going to treat the due process claim on a rational basis ground. Rational basis, I guess if they had one accident in town in the last 10 years and they think this is going to help, it probably passes the rational basis test. So he did not prevail on that ground. Interestingly, he moved on to the Iowa Inalienable Rights Clause. Unlike the federal constitution, the Iowa Constitution has language that originally came from the Virginia Constitution, saying that all citizens have inalienable rights, and looked at some of the jurisprudence construing that. Unfortunately, the Supreme Court also ruled against him and held that this was a valid exercise of the state's police power, and it did not infringe on the Inalienable Rights Clause. And finally, the court also held that this Sioux City ordinance was not preempted by the general state motor vehicle laws. So like I say, he put up a good fight, but he did not prevail. So I guess the lesson for those of us who are maybe a little bit concerned about our liberties, well, maybe we have to win some of those battles in the political arena. Take it up with the city council, take it up with the state legislature, because despite a very valiant argument, I think, here, he didn't quite prevail on that. So speed cameras are A-OK in Iowa, the Supreme Court says. And interestingly, I don't think there was any dissent from that decision. The next case we're going to talk about, also from the Iowa Supreme Court, kind of an interesting jurisdictional issue, question of personal jurisdiction. The case is Sioux Farm Inc. versus Summit Nutritional International. It's a jurisdictional case. The defendant, Summit Nutritional International, was a New Jersey corporation. They had their principal place of business in New Jersey, and they were being sued in Iowa. So, of course, the question, he went to law school, and they talked about this international shoe case from the 1930s. And, you would think in the last 80 years they would finally have that worked out, but there's always one more angle on the question of whether or not a defendant has sufficient jurisdictional contacts with the forum. And with the internet age, we have a new batch of issues coming up with it. The company here, the defendant, like I say, they were based in New Jersey. They didn't really have any contacts with Iowa, other than some Iowa plaintiffs were suing them, except on their website it stated incorrectly that they had a manufacturing facility in Iowa. So you go to their website, and it lists their corporate address in New Jersey, and then it lists their sales office in New Jersey or whatever, and then it says manufacturing facility. And it gives a street address and even a phone number and an email address of a plant located in Iowa. But turns out they do not actually own that facility. They just contract with the company located at that address in Iowa to produce the stuff. So it's just the address of a supplier. They're engaging in a little bit of puffery. Well, the question is that erroneous statement because obviously if they did have a manufacturing facility in Iowa, that would allow for jurisdiction. But how about that erroneous statement on their website that they have a manufacturing facility in Iowa? Well, the district court in this case said that's enough to convey personal jurisdiction. And in fact, that's enough to convey general personal jurisdiction. So in fact, even if they had been, even if they were being sued on something unconnected to that manufacturing, that alleged manufacturing facility in Iowa, they were, you know, sued for a, you know, a traffic accident in New Jersey. Well, the district court held that that was sufficient to convey personal jurisdiction over them. Well, they disagreed with that. They actually brought an interlocutory appeal, and that went up to the Iowa Supreme Court. And the Iowa Supreme Court first agreed with them that the district court was wrong in that holding, that that jurisdictional contact was not enough to convey general jurisdiction over them. In other words, for, you know, for any claim that might ever arise for anything. However, the Iowa Supreme Court went on to affirm on other grounds, and that other ground was that, well, even though it was not sufficient to convey general jurisdiction, in this case, and I didn't really say what the allegations of the complaint were, but the allegations of the complaint about unfair competition apparently involved their statement that they had a manufacturing facility in Iowa. So here, even though it was not sufficient to convey jurisdiction in the general sense, it was sufficient to convey jurisdiction for a cause of action that related to that alleged manufacturing plant in Iowa. So for that reason, they affirmed it on other grounds. So, well, normally, I mean, I guess I would, if you look at my little summary of the case there that I have, I think I played it pretty straight, and I think I have a pretty fair summary of what the Iowa Supreme Court had to say. And in fact, if anything, I probably have some sympathy toward an out-of-state defendant who suddenly has to defend against a lawsuit in Iowa. So I guess if you would have asked me where my sympathies lie in that case, I probably would have said, well, they were with the defendant. But then, a few days after posting this on my website, I got an email from somebody who said that they were the director of information technology of the defendant, and he said that my decision to include this summary on my website represents a bias on my part. So they were out there, he was kind of out there policing their online reputation. And he told me that I should remove it from my website. Because it conveys negative connotations toward them. So therefore he asked me to remove it I think he said something to the effect of to avoid contact between our attorneys or something like that. So I wrote back to him and I said, well, you know, maybe you should have your attorney contact me directly. No, I'm not going to take it down. That raises a couple of interesting points kind of unrelated to the case. First of all, if you ever do send out any kind of cease and desist communication to somebody, keep in mind that there's certainly a possibility that that thing will become a public document at some point. And I've seen a lot of cases where some well-meaning attorney sends out a nasty gram to somebody saying, remove this from your website forthwith, maybe without too many grounds for saying that. Well, when you do send out a letter like that, you do run the risk of that person putting your letter on the website in addition to whatever content was already there, and probably wind up making the client look worse than they were originally. So if you are going to send out letters like that, if you're involved in policing people's online reputation, well, you want to be a little bit careful about it. First of all, make sure that you have grounds for saying it, and bearing in mind that the risk of whatever document you send to them, because if you Google the phrase cease and desist letter, you see a lot of these letters that have been sent to people, and your letter made matters worse. So watch out for that. And the other thing to remember from this case, I guess I do still have a certain amount of sympathy for this this out of town defendant getting sued in another state, probably at a great expense. But one thing that perhaps they didn't realize was when they were getting sued in the district court. Well, if you Google that, you're probably not going to find out any information about it. Whereas a case that goes up to the Court of Appeals or the Supreme Court, those are pretty much publicly available. They will be indexed by Google. If I want to look up court docket in Woodbury County, Iowa, I probably have to go to the court's website. I probably have to do a search. I have to do a little bit of digging. Whereas a case that goes up to the appellate courts, that's going to show up multiple places. It's going to show up on Google Scholar. It's going to show up on the court's website. When somebody Googles the name of that litigant, they will see the litigation. So I guess it serves as a reminder to us that, maybe that's one thing our clients want to consider in deciding whether or not to take an appeal. Because I'm not saying that should defeat the idea of appealing an erroneous decision, but on the other hand, it's a factor that might be important to our clients. I know with when I file articles of incorporation and things like that, there was a time when people didn't really, when they had a phone book, people knew where you lived and everything. If I file articles of incorporation for a home-based business, in Minnesota and probably most states, you need an agent for service of process, and you need to use a street address. And if that street address is somebody's home address, that's what you would normally use. But I remind clients that once you file that with the Secretary of State, well, then your home address is a public record. It's one where somebody has to go in and do a little bit of poking to find it. It's not just going to come up automatically in a Google search. And most clients are okay with that, but occasionally we'll have people with privacy concerns that want to watch out for that. Maybe the most valuable lesson we get out of that particular case is not from the holding, but just from a reminder of some of those privacy issues that that might come up in the practice of law that not legal consequences of it, but that's something you might want to keep in mind. The next case here from the Iowa Supreme Court, and maybe I should go ahead and give our next code number, and our next code number is B77. B77 is our next code number. B as in Bravo 77. B77. So write that down and send it to me at the end of the program for your certificate of attendance. And that should also serve as a reminder that I should just, for those of you taking it live, I should just check my email to see if there are any questions. No, there are not. The next case from the Iowa Supreme Court, kind of an interesting fact pattern, is Jack v. Booth. It was a medical malpractice case. It looks like it was in Polk County. Two physicians getting sued for malpractice, and while one of those doctors was testifying, one of the jurors fainted or was passed out or something. So you have this person passed out in the jury box. The doctor, even though he's getting sued, he also took the Hippocratic Oath, and so he went over to the jury box, attended to this person who had passed out, I guess everybody was okay. It looks like the guy had just fainted. The judge ushered the rest of the jurors out of the room, the juror made a recovery, and I think that juror was replaced. But the trial went on with the remaining jurors, and maybe the alternate. But anyway, there was a question then of, does this warrant a mistrial? And the district court held no. It did not warrant a mistrial, although the district judge took care to keep the rest of the jurors from being exposed to it as much as possible. And I believe the trial judge interviewed all the jurors, and the district court ruled that a mistrial was not warranted, and the verdict went on to be in favor of the two doctors. Well, the plaintiff appealed, and the Iowa Court of Appeals reversed and said, no, there should have been a mistrial because that was just too way out of the ordinary. And, of course, everybody said that the doctor did the right thing, but the question was whether or not a mistrial should be granted. And so the Court of Appeals reversed, ordered a mistrial. Well, interestingly, the doctor who actually treated the stricken juror did not bring any further appeal. But the other doctor, the one who did not do anything to help the juror, apparently, that doctor appealed to the Iowa Supreme Court or sought further review. And she made the argument regardless of whether or not a mistrial should have been granted in the trial of that other doctor, this was a case where there were two separate theories, or the negligence of the two doctors, if any, was independent. It was not they were not guilty of the same malpractice under the plaintiff's theory of the case. It was two separate types of negligence. So the other doctor said, well, yeah, maybe maybe a mistrial should have been granted for the other doctor's case because he got an unfair advantage of being shown to be a hero by bringing this juror back to life. But how did that affect me? Well, and the Iowa Supreme Court agreed with that. They said, yeah, that even though they didn't hold one way or another on whether the other doctor mistrial was appropriate, but they said in her case, her trial was not tainted by that conduct. Now, the plaintiff came up with a theory of, wait a minute, though, but, this made all doctors look good, and she benefited, as a result of that. The Supreme Court said, maybe it did make all doctors look good, including your expert witnesses. They held that the verdict would stand in favor of her, whereas this other poor doctor who did the right thing and treated the stricken person, they had to do it again. Let's see, the next couple of cases we kind of gloss over because time is a little bit, we never have enough time to get through everything that I have planned. So a criminal law case, State v. Love, talks about whether two offenses merge together. In re Marriage of Gust says that the correct procedure, permanent spousal maintenance, or is it called alimony in Iowa? I forget what it's called. Spousal maintenance was ordered on a permanent basis, and one of the spouses said, well, wait a minute, shouldn't there be an adjustment automatically at such time as I take retirement? And they said, and the dissent pointed out that there were some problems with this approach, but the majority opinion said, no, that's the question of how much ability he has to pay after retirement, that's really not ripe because we don't know exactly what his income is going to be upon retirement. So at such time as he retires, well, then he has to come back in and ask for an adjustment. And like I say, the dissent, I think, kind of a tricky question, but they pointed out that approach is maybe a little bit problematic. but that's what they held to be the correct approach. One more case from the Iowa Supreme Court. No, I guess a couple more. A couple of interesting ones. Like I say, the Iowa cases were a lot more interesting than some of the other states this time. But Veach v. City of Waverly. This Ms. Veach was accused of elder abuse. She was at the nursing home, and some of the nurses made the claim anyway that she was pushing her elderly mother into a wheelchair, wheeling her out of view, and screaming at her. They thought that was not the best way to deal with the elders. So the police were called. They did an investigation. They did a fair amount of investigation. They looked at some medical records. They talked to witnesses. They talked to the accused, and she said she didn't want to talk to them. She invoked her right to remain silent. Well, they wound up charging her, but she was acquitted. She was acquitted, and what do you do when you're acquitted? You sue for false arrest. The court looked at it and said, no, even though there was not enough evidence to convict you, apparently, there was still enough probable cause. And in particular, the argument was, well, wait a minute, there was these people at the nursing home, they had it out for me. That's why they called the police in the first place. And this police officer who arrested me, he should have realized that these people had a vendetta against her. And they should have taken that into account. And they said no. The court said no. That does not negate probable cause for the arrest, even though there is a case so holding. But that was kind of an extreme case, and they distinguished the case Kraft versus City of Bettendorf, a 1984 case, where they arrested a guy for being in a barroom brawl, but they didn't even listen to his side of the story because the guy he was brawling with was an off-duty police officer. And they took the off-duty police officer's word for everything basically without even talking to him. Here, I think they just acknowledged, well, no, there were two sides to this story. The police officers heard both sides of them and decided to make the arrest nonetheless. Let's see. I guess we'll talk about this State v. Morris, the DWI. There's not a whole lot in there, so we'll skip over that. This is kind of an interesting case. It's not too relevant to people's practices, I don't think. But anyway, Mr. Morris, he was convicted in 2004 for doing some pretty bad stuff, it looks like. Got two consecutive 25-year terms, so he's in there for a while, and he was ordered to pay restitution in the amount of $16,000. And there was an order, in effect, saying that 20% of any prison earnings would be going to pay off that restitution. Normally, you don't think too much about that because, making 12 cents an hour working in the prison kitchen or whatever. But he was taking part in this program when he got a job earning $10 an hour through the Iowa Prison Industries program. So he was making $10 an hour, and he voluntarily went to court and said, you know what, instead of 20% of my money going to 20% of my wages going toward restitution, I want 50% of my money going toward restitution. Well, normally you would think the state of Iowa would recognize that he's taking responsibility for his actions, and he wants to make sure that that his victims receive their proper restitution. And normally you would think that would be commendable, but no, that's not what happened. When the state of Iowa, when the Department of Corrections caught wind of that, they said, "Well, wait a minute, you can't be paying restitution to the victims because we want you paying money to the state of Iowa for your room and board in the prison." And the statute under which the prison earnings are governed, the reason they made this objection is because that statute has certain priorities. It says out of the inmate's paycheck, first this will be paid, second this will be paid, third this will be paid. How that statute happened to work in his case was that it reduced the amount of money that was going to the state by diverting it to the victim. And the state said, no, we don't want the victim getting the money. We want it to go into the state treasury. But the Supreme Court agreed with him and said, no, the statute, you have to read it carefully, but there are really no ambiguities in the statute. And if the inmate wants to voluntarily increase the amount, that is okay. And then I guess our last Iowa case I'll just hit on briefly. It's an OWI or DWI case, and it's clear that there was reasonable suspicion to make the stop. But there was a little bit of ambiguity in the statute because the statute says in every state, I know Minnesota has similar language about the times when, because there are three kinds of tests, blood, urine, and breath. And the statute says that a certain test shall be required. The way the court construed, because this person wanted a blood test and she had only been given a breath test or one of those things. So she took this language and said, well, it says that the kind of test I want shall be required. So therefore they did not give me that test. They did not give me the test that shall be required. And the court basically looked at that and said, no, the words shall be required means that the driver shall be required to take such a test if ordered. It does not mean that the state shall be required to offer that particular test. So it was a little bit of an ambiguity in the statute that got resolved. This time we're about halfway through, so we'll give you our next code number. Our next code number is C15. C as in Charlie, 1-5. C15. C15 is the third code word of about six that we're going to be giving. C15. C as in Charlie, 1-5 is the third code word. And we now turn back to the beginning of the case materials, and we're going to be looking at some Minnesota Supreme Court cases before we move on to some of the other states. First case, kind of a long summary here. There's not a whole lot that has to be said. It's a case involving sovereign immunity, and there's a Minnesota has apparently a Depression era statute. It sounds like think in terms of grapes of wrath. So if you induce people to come to Minnesota to get employment. So if I put a help wanted ad,
The host has joined the conference.
Well, hello. I hope I didn't lose too many people. I don't know what happened. I got disconnected there. I don't know if you've gotten the last code number, so I'll give that again. C15. C as in Charlie, 15. C15 is the code number I gave right before we got cut off for some reason, but I'm glad to see, I see most of you are still on the line here. So my apologies for that, but we are back. Anyway, I'm talking about Nichols v. State of Minnesota. There's a Minnesota statute that says that if you induce somebody to come to the state to seek employment, and you use, you include false representations as part of that, well, there's a civil cause of action. And the question is, does that statute apply to the state of Minnesota? So, or is it a case where the state of Minnesota has sovereign immunity? Well, the statute says, you know, any person or organization who engages in that conduct. But in this case, in the Nichols case, the court said that no, that that kind of general language that's saying anybody who commits this kind of conduct is liable for violation, even though that's a very broad language, that by itself does not include the state of Minnesota in the is imposing liability. So again, you have to look at the general state Tort Claim Act, and there is not liability for that. So so the state of Minnesota is not not liable for violating that statute. The next case, State versus Beaulieu, probation revocation. In a probation revocation hearing, the court is supposed to recite various rights that the probationer has. In fact, those are basically the rights set forth by the Morris v. Brewer case, and that's incorporated into the Minnesota Rules of Criminal Procedure. The person has to be told that they have a right to a hearing and so forth. In this case, the judge didn't do that, but he revoked somebody's probation notwithstanding that. But even though it was a pretty clear violation of the rules of criminal procedure and that that constitutional requirement from the Supreme Court, the court held that it was not objected to, obviously, at the time, and the person was represented by an attorney. So therefore, they would examine it for plain error, and they held that under the plain error standard, it was not a serious enough violation to warrant a reversal of the person's probation being revoked. The next case on the materials, Burrell v. State of Minnesota, pretty really is not too relevant beyond the facts of the case, so I think we'll gloss over that one in the interest of time. Well, as is the case following it, the Benton case. This poor guy didn't have too much of a defense. I guess he tried his best. He was convicted of first degree murder after the victim had multiple stab wounds, and he said, "Well, she committed suicide, but I stabbed her once to settle her down." Well, that apparently the defense didn't go over too well with the jury. I don't think he bothered appealing that decision. Well, you know, if you're a state public defender, you kind of you have to take what's given to you. And the only potential error they could find here was that on two occasions the courtroom was closed to the public. But that was at the request of the defense attorney, and the defendant consented to that. So in light of the fact that that he asked for the public to be removed for those for a couple of bench conferences, he didn't really have any right to complain. So that conviction was affirmed. Our fourth code number for the program is D22. D as in Delta 22. D22 is the fourth of probably six code words that we'll be giving tonight. So write that down unless you're in traffic or something. D22 is the fourth code word. The next case, Salyers talks about possession in the context of whether or not somebody is in possession of a firearm, or no, possession of stolen property, I guess. But it could be possession of anything. He was being served a warrant for being in possession or for having stolen property. But he was a felon and he was in possession of a firearm, which he was not supposed to be. And the firearm in this case was in a safe, but really it wasn't even a very heavy-duty safe. It was more like a file cabinet that the police officers easily pried open during the time that they were serving the warrant. And his argument was, well, I wasn't in possession of that. It was the safe was in possession of it. But they said, no, given the facts of this case, it was in your bedroom. It was in a home where you live alone. So you were pretty clearly in possession of the firearm. For purposes of that statute. Now, if other people had lived there, or if maybe it would be a different case. But based upon all the facts of this, it was pretty clear that he was in possession of it. Another internet-related case. We had one already, but next one: Sprinkler Warehouse versus Systematic Rain. The question is: Is a website or a domain name, is that garnishable property? There was a default judgment against the defendant in Texas. It got docketed in a Minnesota court, and the plaintiff served a garnishment summons on one of the officers of the company. They asked, the garnishment summons in Minnesota says, do you have any property that belongs to the defendant? And they said no. But they raised the point, but the website for this company, it's registered in your name. So you can sign it over. So the question is that website garnishable property and the domain name? So the defendant, I guess it was Systematic Rain, they owned, systematicrain.com or whatever. I don't remember what the website was, but they had a website and they had a domain name. And the Minnesota Court of Appeals held that both of those pieces of property, the website and the domain name, were the property, and they were subject to garnishment. And they lay out the procedure here for dealing with that because when you garnish it, if you garnish a bank account, the person has you have a judgment for $5,000 and you get $1,000 out of the bank account, well, that's a pretty easy matter, to figure out how much of the judgment has been satisfied. But when you take some other piece of property, especially something as ephemeral as a website, you have to figure out how to value it. So they lay out the procedure for doing it. And what the procedure is, the court has to order a sale, a receiver has to be appointed to sell it, and then whatever value it sells for, that's how much of the judgment will be satisfied. So I guess realistically you have probably most cases you would have two people bidding at that sale, the plaintiff and the defendant, and I guess you'd have to employ a little bit of strategy to figure out exactly how much you're going to bid on it. But that's the procedure. So, yes, those are garnishable property. That's how you do it. Persegal case, next one here. That's pretty if you are a landlord who collects the utilities directly from your client, well, then you're going to want to read this case and you're going to want to read this statute, because if you bill the utilities separately, there's a statute for dealing with that. And after reading the statute, I guess I conclude I can see why apartment buildings have separate meters and let their let the tenants deal directly with the power company, because if you get involved in the utility business, that statute looks like probably makes your life kind of difficult. The exact holding of this case is that you can assess fees for credit card payments and so forth. Like I say, not too relevant if you're not in that situation, because it's a pretty specific statute. One foreclosure case here, Twait v. MidFirst Bank, construing the statute, because certain actions have to be taken in a certain time before the commencement of the foreclosure. That begs the question is, well, when is the foreclosure commenced for purposes of those statutes? And the holding of this case is the date of first publication, because in Minnesota, you most foreclosures are done by publication. So the date that you put that first ad in Finance and Commerce or wherever you put it, that's the date when the foreclosure begins. For purposes of timing under that. This Nielsen case simply says that under the civil commitment statute, which those of you in Minnesota are probably aware that's kind of a hot issue, some constitutional issues about civil commitment basically sexual predators are lurking out there. Well, this case simply holds that the county attorney does not have to wait until release is imminent. Those civil commitment proceedings can be started, even though in this particular case the guy is not going to be eligible for release for a couple more years. Let's see, Munger, another probation, registration of predatory offenders. So take a look at that case if you need to know more about that, because, yeah, we only have about 10 minutes left here, so we have to kind of pick up the pace, I guess. I will give our next code number, our second to the last. The fifth code word is E14, E as in Echo 1-4, E14. Is our next code word. And I will just check my email again here. Okay, hopefully we weren't cut off too long, because I didn't get any emails from somebody saying I was cut off. But our next to the last code word is E14. E is in Echo 1-4. This O'Connell case deals with a Supreme Court decision of Missouri versus McNeely, which held that you don't get an automatic exigent circumstance in any DWI case just by saying that the alcohol is going to dissipate. You have to be a little bit not to say it can't be used, but you have to be a little bit more particularized in your facts when you're making that argument. But it's not an automatic exigent circumstance just to say that, well, the blood or the alcohol is eventually going to dissipate from this driver's blood. But that was the case in years past, apparently in Mr. O'Connell's DWI case. And he argued that, I think in a, I don't know if it was a post-conviction some kind of post-conviction relief. He was saying that that case should be applied retroactively, but the Minnesota Court of Appeals said that that would not be applied retroactively. And once again, the fifth code word is E14. Well, we'll just turn to Wisconsin here. I see we have a few Wisconsin callers on the line, so we'll look at some of the Wisconsin Court of Appeals cases quickly. We have a zoning case. I guess we don't have any Wisconsin Supreme Court cases right now, but we have a couple from the Court of Appeals. I think all these are published decisions. Zoning, the town of Cedarburg wanted to give citations to some homeowners who were renting out their homes on short-term rentals, and they pointed to the town zoning ordinance, which said that this area was zoned for single-family residential only. Well, the Court of Appeals looked at it and said, well, that's exactly what was going on here. It was a single family residing in that house. And they did not say that you could, they could not ban, they said it might be possible to ban rentals in a zoning ordinance. But when you're dealing with people's property rights, you have to be a lot more specific in the ordinance. So here, just because the statute said single family residential, that's exactly the use that was being made of these homes, even though the single family residing in them was not necessarily the people who owned it. The Nina Foundry case, I don't know if you've noticed, if you ever look at the, if you look down when you're crossing the street as you walk over, manhole covers. 9 times out of 10, the manhole cover will say Nina Foundry on it. But apparently they haven't been making a lot of manhole covers recently because the Nina Foundry went into bankruptcy. But they were able to start up. They transferred the assets to somebody else, and there was a Chapter 11 reorganization. And they reopened the factory, but the question arose of what is their experience rating for unemployment insurance purposes? So the state of Wisconsin took the position that this new owner was the mandatory successor of the previous owner, and therefore they would inherit their experience rating, because obviously there had been a lot of layoffs right before the bankruptcy, so they had kind of a bad record as far as unemployment, and made a pretty substantial amount and difference in how much they would have to pay for unemployment insurance. And they argued that first of all, under the Wisconsin statute, they argued that they were really like a new owner, and the court didn't go along with that. And they also argued, I think more importantly, that, well, wait a minute, this is really preempted by federal bankruptcy law, the purpose of federal bankruptcy law is to give people a fresh start, and if this new incarnation of the company is burdened by this previous unemployment history, that's not going to serve the federal bankruptcy principles. But the Court of Appeals said no. Based upon the facts of that case, they inherited the experience rating of the previous incarnation, and they were stuck paying the higher unemployment rates. Let's see, this next one, Johnson v. Cintas Corporation, an offer of settlement, that affects the judgment rate, after that is made. This construes that provision. The last Wisconsin case we have a chance to take a look at is Carlson v. Fidelity Motor Group. It's a personal jurisdiction case. They bought a car from somebody in Illinois who was I think it was Illinois, but they were advertising it on cars.com. But the Wisconsin Court of Appeals, I think, correctly said, no, the mere fact that this Illinois car dealer is advertising on cars.com, does not give rise to personal jurisdiction in Wisconsin. So they have to, if they have a lawsuit, they're going to have to take it to the other state. Let's see, a couple cases from the Iowa Court of Appeals. criminal case. The U.S. Supreme Court recently held in Riley v. California that cell phone that you have in your pocket, you might have some privacy concerns in connection with that. That got applied here because this, not a very compelling litigant, because some cars had been broken into. They found a very suspicious looking person walking around the neighborhood, without a jacket, 20 degree weather. She had a phone in her pocket. Police officers took a look at it, and one of the messages that they found in the phone was to the effect, well, it said, "Let's go out and steal from cars tonight." That's not very good, or that's a pretty strong case against the defendant, I would say. The U.S. Supreme Court and the Iowa Court of Appeals said, no, you need a warrant for that. The state realized that because that case had come down in the intervening time, and they argued that there were some exigent circumstances, but the Court of Appeals didn't see that. So you need a warrant to rifle through people's, what does the Fourth Amendment say, effects? Well, I guess those are your virtual effects that are stored inside your phone. And then finally, the last Iowa case we have time to look at deals with landlocked property. And I know different states deal with this differently. In Minnesota, we have a statute called a cartway. If you have landlocked property, then you have a right to petition for a cartway. Well, in Iowa, it is called private condemnation. You're acting basically the same position as the state, and you're doing an eminent domain over your adjoining property owner's property to create an easement leading from your property to a public road. The lesson from this Finnegan case is that you have to strictly follow the language of that statute. Because that statute lays out a number of preferences for how that pathway should run. Specifically, it says it should go over the natural boundary line between 40 acre parcels. Here in this case, there was such a line. There was a 40 line running through a public road. But it was not a very, it was not the preferred route. It was longer, it had a steeper grade, I think everybody agreed that there was a lot better route, closer to the road, the district judge, I think, did a pretty common sense decision and said, well, we can't do it over the 40 line, we'll do it over the 10 acre line. We'll take a 40-acre parcel, draw a line along, down the middle of it, and run the road along that. So, pretty reasonable decision, but unfortunately, that's not what the statute says. They were not allowed to do that. I will talk briefly about the last couple of cases here, but for those of you who might have to get away at the scheduled time, I'll go ahead and give our final code number. It is F59. F is in Fox 59. F59. F59 is the last code word. And also, if any of you joined us late, at the very conclusion, we'll go over a little bit. So if any of you joined us late, I will give the first code word again. So if you missed that because you had to call in late, you'll still get your full 1 hour. And we will just turn briefly to a couple of cases from the Indiana Supreme Court that are kind of interest, I think. The first one, Study v. Indiana, talks about the statute of limitations. The defendant was charged with a bank robbery, and he was charged after the statute of limitations had run out. I think it was a 4-year statute of limitations. But there are many exceptions to the statute of limitations, and one of those is the statute of limitations is told due to concealment. So the state argued, well, we needed extra time because this guy was concealing the fact that he had been involved in this crime. Well, the Indiana Supreme Court said that, well, the concealment has to be pretty, it has to mean something, and in every criminal case there is a certain amount of concealment unless you march into the police station and say, I confess. So basically the type of concealment they hold, what you have to conceal that there actually was an offense. There has to be some overt concealment. It can't just be, trying to stay in the shadows and not get caught. You have to take some positive action, to.
The host has joined the conference.
Hi, if anybody is still out there, thanks for joining me. I got cut off there right at the end, but we were basically finished. So thank you for joining us this evening, and look forward to seeing you in future programs.